This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And you have you ever thought about where quantum computing could take your portfolio? Investment themes from Interactive Brokers helps you find out. Start with a trend like quantum computing or even clean energy and instantly see where companies are most connected based on revenue, strategic focus, and maybe even product relevance. You could explore competitors, global exposure, and business relationships across more than 500 themes. Built with AI-powered insights from Reflexivity, Investment Themes turns complexity into clarity and helps you move from trend to trade with speed. Available now across IBKR desktop, mobile, and Traders Workstation. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Check it out at IBKR.com/themes.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Emperor has some new clothes. A closer look at valuations, tariffs, under fire, and our guest today is Manuel Blay. From the DowTheory.com. All this and much more on episode number 946 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hey there, and welcome. It's Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me. Thanks for coming each and every week to The Disciplined Investor and listening in on what we have to say and the great guests that we bring you each and every week. It's another week in paradise, I got to tell you, but not so much in the markets. A lot of flim-flamming going on, a lot of concern about some of the things that happened. We're going to get down to what happened because there was something important that happened last week that I think was a watershed moment. The reality is that, well, the emperor's clothes were revealed. And we're going to talk about that story in a second. But one of the big things that I was concerned about and I've been looking at is, you know, some of the reality points behind the scenes of what are valuations looking like. And we're going to get into a discussion more of this with our guest today as well. But, you know, there's things that are haunting markets. You know, we have these trade deal, non-trade deal, agreements, frameworks, non-frameworks, reversals. You know, we have things that are going on with regard to deals with Medicare and government being shut, being open, and political funniness going on. All these things, right? We have bills that are happening. We have debt that's piling up. We have the Fed that's talking. We have companies that are talking. But let's get down to some of the numbers just for a moment to look at what is really running this current market theme. And that is that nothing's going to go wrong, that no matter how much pressure is put upon the debt load of the government, the debt load of individual companies, the stress that is put on individuals and consumers due to tariffs, inflation, pricing, lack of jobs, none of that matters, right? Everything's just going to be fine because we're going to look beyond it. We're going to sweep it under the rug. We're going to be like, hey, it doesn't really matter. Because sometime in the future, things are going to work out. But the truth of the matter is that with regard to the hope trade, as you would call it, that doesn't always work out in the favor of investors. In fact, we've seen time and time again where it really does do a great job when you're looking at the momentum or the trade that you have, the trend trade, if you will, the trend following, where you look at that and you think about where things are and where they're going and how it is the best to be on the side of the trend when it is working in your favor and to hopefully somehow magically hop off when the timing's just right, when things turn, not too early, not too late. Halfway to impossible to do that. Now, there are times that there are strokes of brilliance that you'll have. There'll be times when you lighten up on a portfolio or add to it when it seems like the most inappropriate times to do so, but it turns out to be right. We can't chalk that up to genius. We got to chalk that up to luck. But one of the things that's going on right now, and even though most people are not focusing on fundamentals, is that when we look at last month, the end of last month in October, just a few days ago, and we look at the S&P 500, the forward 12-month price-earnings ratio was 23.1, which marked its third consecutive day at that point above 23. Why is that important? Well, we look at the closing price of the S&P 500 on October 31st, and that was 68.90, and the EPS on the estimates looking out by the analysts, looking at all the data they have, is about $298 and change. Well, how does that compare historically? We'll look at some of the numbers from FactSet. And this 23.1 number that we had again on the at the end, it's a little bit lower now because of the sell-off, but at the end of October, we look at the averages over time, the five-year average, 19.9. 10-year average, 18.6. 20-year average, 16.1. 25-year average, 16.3. Now, what has happened is that investors are that much more enthusiastic over buying stocks and the opportunity for companies to do well in the future, and they're willing to pay up for that. You look at the 25-year average. 25-year average at 16, and we're coming at 23 at this point, meaning we're far above the average at this time, and that happens from time to time. And then it corrects. Doesn't have to go far under. Doesn't have to go to a 12 or a 10. Those are recession-like kinds of levels. But what we have to see is a reversion back to the mean somewhere maybe in the 10-year range, about 18.6, and that's not too hard to do. That's probably a your regular run-of-the-mill 10% correction of markets, which would not surprise me in the least with what we've seen in terms of total performance and the valuation game. Where we see this, you know, it's a little bit concerning because the last time that the S&P 500 saw a PE ratio above 23 was when? September 2nd, 2020, 23.4. That's when everybody was all excited at that point about all the money coming in, right? All the freebies coming in. And while today's level is elevated, it still remains under the 30-year peak back in 2000, at 24.4. But here's even more of an issue. If you look and you start breaking this down and looking at, for example, the sectors, information technology, the current PE is 32 versus the 20.3 25-year average. Consumer discretionary, 29.2. Wow. The average is 20 for consumer discretionary. The thought is, I guess, that every consumer is just out there shopping their brains out, emptying their wallets and building up debt, credit. Industrials at 24.5 versus 17. Industrials. Now, there's some interest in there, but to thinking about building out the infrastructure. Communication services, 22.1 versus 16. Real estate lacks a 25-year average for comparison. So, what's the key point and the takeaways here? Number one, the current forward PE that we saw on October 31st at 23.1, well above historical norms. No question about that. And that signals stretched valuations in my books. 10 sectors exceeded their 25-year average, led by tech and consumer discretionary. This elevation in the PE ratios clearly suggests exceptional optimism, but also raises questions, I think, about the sustainability of the rally. And the big drivers, what are they? What's the backdrop of this? Well, we got the strong price gains that were clearly outpacing earnings growth, and the concentrated strength in the high-value sectors like technology and communication services and things like that. So it's no surprise that we may see a little bit of a backup here, maybe back to the 50-day moving average. Would not be a surprise at all. We have other things that are going a little bit cockeyed right now. Look at the tariff situation, right? For the questions that were being asked by the Supreme Court justices this week, To me, it doesn't seem like the tariffs are going to be upheld. Now, there may be some weird things that go on behind the scenes, but if in fact any of the very tough questions that were being asked pretty much by all of the Supreme Court justices are an indication, it seems to me that we got a problem here. It was really interesting to watch as these questions came in rapid fire during the day. I think it was it Wednesday? And for the most part, contrary to what I initially thought, I thought they were going to be kind of like, let's just see what happens. And you know, no, they were asking some really pointed questions. And again, against my surprise, it appears that no matter what and who appointed them, they seem pretty cold on this whole idea that Congress can give up the power that were entrusted to them in these type of tariffs, saying that basically, or asking the question that if in fact, or didn't, they pointed it. It was kind of a leading point question. If Congress was to give this up and we were to grant this, it'd be very difficult for Congress to ever get it back. And that was a big issue. One by one, they seem to be suggesting that by allowing these powers, the executive branch would just keep it forever. And also what they seem to have said, the undertone of the conversation was that it doesn't seem that it's so legal. So how does this shake out long term? Well, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent was saying that they're going to use other powers. Don't worry about it. We'll make sure these tariffs stick. But what if they can't? What about all these deals? Clearly, other countries will be laughing at us pretty hard, right? And saying, oh, I don't know. You know what? These deals that we cut, we're backing them off. Not only that, we would lose our bargaining chip, quote unquote, for whatever these deals, these crappy deals, these good deals, whatever they are, which nobody seems to really know, except what we hear from the, you know, the talking heads and the talking points from the Republican Party and Fox News. CNN's, of course, against it like all hell. But, you know, that's what you get, right? Fox News is for it. They love tariffs. They're the best thing ever. They're going to hold. And now what? Well, even President Trump is saying that it would be a total disaster. Again, he would really be neutered in a lot of ways economically with his international. I mean, he pissed off enough countries around the world that now they're just going to be like, look at that. We can get back pretty well on this. Something to consider. And in other news, there's something that's a little bit off. This under-the-radar discussion, I don't know if you saw this last week. OpenAI. This is the company by Sam Altman, right? ChatGPT. They are promising more money than most people ever thought of to fund all this buildup, $1 trillion. Now they're thinking about or asking the government, U.S. government, to back its debt. What? I mean, I know that they're promising all this money that they don't have. So now what? You can believe that they're begging the government at this point because they have a problem. Can you believe this? I mean, the government would back the $1 trillion spending spree? I don't think so. Speaking at the Wall Street Journal Business Conference, OpenAI CFO Sarah Friar explained that government backing could help attract the enormous investment needed for AI computing and infrastructure, given the uncertain lifespan of AI data centers. What? Wait, what? What is that? What does that sound? Oh, that's the House of Cards toppling down. This is exactly what we've been talking about the promises, the circular, the financing, the debt financing, the vendor financing. All of a sudden, what we're seeing is this OpenAI is going out and needing to all of a sudden raise debt to fund these promises? And they want to do it at lower cost by the government? What? Begging the government to back it so they can get lower pricing? Already the government came back and said, no, ixnay, no skay, not happening. There will be no bailout for AI. That's what they said. So that really doused the whole rally with some cold water. We saw the major names take a big hit last week, twice during the week, even after some good earnings for some. And this is like a Pied Piper, well, maybe not a Pied Piper moment. Maybe it's the Emperor's New Clothes. The basis that they fooled everyone into going along with the scheme until all of a sudden the truth was revealed. Remember this? The Emperor's New Clothes is a classic tale by Hans Christian Andersen. about vanity, about deception. And it tells the story of the emperor obsessed with fine clothing. He hires two swindlers that claim that they can make garments invisible to anyone who is either incompetent or foolish. So he's eager. The emperor's eager. He decides, well, I'm going to pretend to see the non-existent clothes and parade them through the city. And all his subjects around, fearing to seem kind of unfit and stupid, right? They said, wow, that's magnificent attire. Until all of a sudden, an innocent child points out the emperor is wearing nothing at all. And that story highlights the themes of pride and conformity. That's a big issue that's going on right now, this idea of conformity. And then the courage to speak the truth. The truth sometimes is spoken not by someone, but an action. So, was the government basically the innocent child's reality moment by saying, well, you know, we're not doing this? And here's the problem. All the things that we've been looking at that have been propping up markets are the things that also can be basically demolished very quickly. Much of the government deals, like the tariffs, can be reversed. And, oh, did you see that the rare earth deal, by the way, that was so great, it's unraveling already? There's too much pomp and circumstance, and it's making its way from the top down. So that much fluff is basically easily obliterated. And that's what's happening. That's what I was talking about for weeks about this whole issue with regard to, the circular financing. And this is what I was getting to. All right, let's take a minute. Let's talk about Interactive Brokers, and we're going to get to our guest, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are just from 4.37 to 5.37%. In fact, IBKR was rated one of the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. I want you to compare IBKR's clients' low margin borrowing costs to other brokers like Schwab, E-Trade, Fidelity, and Vanguard, who charge hundreds of basis points above IBKR's low rates. You know, the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Understand that margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance. You may lose more than your initial investment. Rates, of course, are subject to change. IBKR is a member of SIPC. Get started today at IBKR.com/compare. Now, Manuel Blay is our guest today. He's the editor of thedowtheory.com, a top-ranked investment letter that has garnered a remarkable reputation for assisting investors in navigating bear markets while maximizing profits during bull markets. His investment letter is frequently sought after by places like Forbes and MarketWatch, Yahoo, plenty of places. He's also extended the application of the Dow Theory beyond stocks to encompass U.S. bonds and precious materials. So let's get right to it. All right, Manuel, how are you? It's been a little while, not too long. But how's it going?
Well, everything is fine. I think we are going to reconnect. We left last time at capitulation and we nailed it.
Oh, I remember that. I remember that. Yeah, that was in April of this year where the proverbial shit was hitting the fan. And you had talked about that this was looking like a capitulation point at that moment. In fact, some of your indicators were starting to flash that there was a buy point.
Exactly. So I hope to reconnect where we left. So we left at capitulations. Yep. So we nailed down the bottom. So let's see what's in store for us now.
So a couple of things. I just read your letter, the DowTheory.com letter. And across the top, the Dow Theory for the 21st century, the Blade Timing Indicator, the Composite Indicator, green, green, green.
Yeah,
everything's go, 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 load up, back up the truck. Let's get the cash moving, right? That's what that's saying.
Yeah, this is what I'm doing because we became invested at capitulation. So can you imagine we are riding the bull?
Right. Yeah. Riding the bull. Well, sometimes the bull bucks off when you ride it if it moves too fast. But so let's talk about the capitulation point and usually what happens moving forward. Let's kind of set the stage. So we had this capitulation point. We had a fabulous run from that point till now, right? Where a couple little bitty movements to the downside, nothing terrible. A few days here, a few days there, right? And then it just came back. And of course, until through last week, we were at, you know, all-time highs. But so what from there, what happens? In particular, the question I'm going to ask you is, with what exactly happened with that drop from February to April? Because from what I talked to you about, it wasn't just a simple correction, right?
It was a bear market. Yeah. And you know what happens? That the standard definition of minus 20% on the S&P, okay, it's a gauge, but it's not the best way to appraise the end of a bull market. You know that we use what Shannon in our website developed, which is our bull and bear definition. And our bear definition entails, yes, a minus 16% drop, but on the S&P and in the Dow Industrial. So we look for confirmation. But you, when you use the two indexes, you don't need to require 20% on the S&P. So you are satisfied with, yes, minus 16%, but on both the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500. So you have much greater accuracy. This is something I explained in the
video. Is that, hold on a second, is that
yeah.
the average of the two? Is it one or the other? No. What does it mean?
Each one must drop minus 16%.
At least 16% for each one.
At least.
Okay, gotcha.
For each one.
Okay.
So it's confirmation. Confirmation. Uh-huh. So for instance, if you have minus 21% on the S&P, for instance, and just minus 15% on the Dow Industrials, we are not in a bear market. And maybe you will ask, okay, why it's so important? Yes, because it gives you a framework. For instance, now if you look at analysts, I think to the exception of Morgan Stanley, I think the rest of analysts are saying that we just had a correction, so that we have an old bull market that is already 3 years old. But according to our definition of a bear market, we had a bear market, and now we are in a young, new bull market. So the framework is totally different. So, for instance, we had a torrid bull run-up. This is typical of new bull markets. Mm-hmm. This is not typical of an old bull market. And this is why many analysts are saying, look, it's bizarre. We have an old bull market that is behaving like a new bull market. So they are scratching their heads because something doesn't fit. And what does not fit is the standard definition of a bear market. So it is not just to look cute and say, oh, look, I'm cute, I have a different definition. No, because with our definition of bull and bear markets, you are really much more accurate with the rhythm, with the flow, with the ebb and flow of bull and bear markets. So it's not just to look intelligent or smart. No, it really has a real use. Furthermore, you could even time the market just based on our bull and bear market definition.
So, but let me just go backwards, and I want to ask a question here. What's the significance? I mean, more recently, in recent history, we've seen that a bear market happens quickly. We know that bear markets happen much more quickly than bull markets, right? It's a quick swoosh down. But it doesn't always mean that it has to be a V recovery into a bull market right from there, does it? It could last a long period of time where there is a sideways motion to markets like we had back in the 70s, sometime in the 80s, sometime in the 90s. And all of a sudden we got into for that matter, the NASDAQ was in I don't even know what it was in. It was in a slog from 2000 mm-hmm. through 2010? It's like 10 years of nothingness, right?
Well, it depends. But if you catch the bottom, it's not so much of nothingness. It depends.
Right. No, if you catch the bottom, I get it. But does a bull market always have to follow a bear market? Is that
eventually it follows because we also have our bull market definition, which is plus 19% on both the industrials and the S&P 500. So sooner or later, you're going to get a plus 19% rally. And then you will get your bull market definition. But of course, if neither index rallies by 19% or more, then you can get stuck for many years in a bear market because the bear market will persist until it is reversed by a bull market. So you know that we always give the benefit of the doubt to the prevailing trend. So if we had the bear market definition, for us, it will be a bear market until we get the reverse signal, which is the bull market definition.
Just to be clear, I did a little math here.
Yeah.
You take $100, you take 16% off, you get 84. Yeah. You multiply that by a 19% increase, you're back to zero. So what you're saying to me is, in a different way, 16% off, 19% on, you basically erase the bear market.
Exactly. And furthermore, it's kind of the reciprocal. 19 is kind of a reciprocal of 16.
So right.
In other words, what you lost, you need 19% to recover, roughly.
And that you consider that's when we enter the bull market at that point?
Exactly.
So do you wait to pull the trigger? Do you wait to pull the trigger until that
point? No. My friend. This is a different issue. One thing is to have the framework, so your reference. But of course, we're market timers. So for instance, we got capitulation on April 8th. So we nailed the bottom. So at that time, we went invested already 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't wait until the bull definition. The bull definition in this new bull market was signal, I think, was on July 3rd. So on July 3rd was the first day when the Dow Industrials and the S&P 500 rallied jointly by more than 19% off the April lows.
Which, by the way, is a pretty good run.
On that date, we got the plus 19% off the April lows. But I didn't wait that. I was already full invested by that time. So, because the bull bear market definition gives you a framework, so to know in which waters you are navigating. But good market timing doesn't wait too long. For instance, we got partially out of the market in early March. I think it was March 3rd or March 4th. So well before the bear market definition, because our Dow theory triggered a sell signal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the magic. This is the magic of market timing. So you don't wait until the bear market is official or to buy. You don't wait until the bull market is official. So normally you will get several signals. For instance, on April 8th, we got capitulation. So it was for us a signal to go 50% invested. But watch out, I became bullish on April, even more bullish after nailing the bottom, on April 24th. Why? Because we had a strike, a breadth thrust. And these breadth thrusts are followed really by very strong price action. So, of course, I didn't wait to go 100% invested until the bull market definition. So long before we were already fully invested. But, of course, let's imagine you don't get capitulation. Because sometimes you don't get capitulation. You don't get a thrust. You don't get the authorities by signal. You get nothing. Then your entry point of last resort is going to be the bull market definition. This is true. Like the bear market definition is going to be your exit point of last resort. But of course, we have plenty of tools in our toolbox to derive buy and sell signals.
So here we are.
So I don't know if
you know, I get it. I understand. The here we are in an unusually strong, very quick bull market. You're saying, I'm just going to repeat this back to you. You're saying it's a new bull market, which has different characteristics of a old bull market, let's just say, because old bull markets run out of steam, right? And then they kind of roll.
Yeah.
But both could happen. But I'm just saying, generally speaking, an old bull market could run out of steam. It could be exhausted after a while. And you'll see that at the end where people just finally just say, screw it and capitulate on the inside by throwing their money in, right? Whereas a new bull market, it's like a lot of people were out. You bring in new investors. It has a lot more gain potential. That's where you get the Marty Zweig thrust indicator as strong as we saw it back then. And it has different characteristics, which could, in effect, last a lot longer. Is that the summation of what you just said?
Yeah, that's it. It's a new bull market. And the strongest rally in a bull market are the first 6 months. Don't forget that as well.
We're right now at the end of that 6 month period.
My friend, because now I expect a little bit of choppiness. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit choppy.
It's funny. I mean, look, I've been very vocal about, look, I said, there is a lot of wrong with what's going on out there. As a matter of fact, at the top of the show, I talked about the fundamentals, that the price, you didn't hear this, so I'll repeat this for you. The price earnings ratio of the S&P 500 on a forward basis on October 31st was 23.1, which, by the way, was the highest since like 20 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot. You know, the average, let's say 10-year is 18.6. Mm-hmm. 23.1 is a lot. So the idea that we can continue just going up and up and up, look, bull markets could last a long time, but every once in a while we got to refresh, don't we, inside of the bull market?
Yeah, we need a refresher, and I think it's coming right now, because even though it's a young bull market, first off, the first 6 months of this bull market have elapsed. So it's young, but the first big thrust is over. Furthermore, we had the Zweig, I think it's in English, Zweig. Thrust.
Yeah,
Zweig. Yeah, in German it would be Zweig, but you pronounce it the right. Zweig, breath thrust. So, but if you look at the historical thrust, we have achieved in 6 months what is normally achieved in 1 year. Mm-hmm. So in other words, more. We have achieved more than what is normally achieved in 1 year. So in other words, I think that lots of the powder is already burned.
Yes.
So thrust was very powerful. Furthermore, we had capitulation. So we had all the ingredients at new bull market, capitulation and thrust. So we had really a triad, a very bullish triad. But most of this powder is already burned, because okay, capitulation also entails higher prices, but we had an unbelievable run.
I mean, think about it. I mean, the vision that I have from what you're talking about is like a rocket going up to space. That initial thrust is the most powerful of what you can get, because it needs to lift off, mm-hmm. and then it separates, and we get the solid rocket boosters that go down, and then we get. From there, a change of the next secondary thrust mechanism. And then potentially then it's just operating on much smaller thrusters to keep the velocity mm-hmm. going.
Right. It's momentum. Yeah.
So again, this idea of a, so what are you looking at? Let me ask you this. Yeah. All right. I get it that you are cemented in that this is a young bull market and that, it's going to last. What would change your mind? What is the next thing that could happen? Like, in other words, tell me what happens if you're like, well, okay, that's what it was, but now all of a sudden the signals are changing.
Two things. I don't know. Liquidity and earnings. So now there are tensions with the liquidity. You know, the repos, there is some tensions in the liquidity markets. But I consider it is a liquidity small crisis, but not a solvency crisis, this is important.
Okay, so not a solvency crisis, okay.
No, it's not a solvency crisis, it's just a liquidity crisis, because you know better than I, the DTA account, Federal Reserve, all these things. So the Treasury is draining. It's draining liquidity from the system. There is the government shutdown, so receipts keep coming in, but there is no expenditures. And well, all these things was the end of the month, which is also window dressing for banks. So all in all, there was some liquidity issues, but it's not a solvency issue.
Okay.
So I would change my mind if this, what I consider is just a temporary liquidity issue, turned into a solvency issue. Then what you have to look at, then look at high yield bonds. In the very moment you see that the spread of high yield bonds starts to boom, to rocket, then Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah. But the liquidity issue, mm-hmm. it's interesting, because one of the big drivers of liquidity this year has been, with one big beautiful bill act, the OBA. One of the big things was, oh my gosh, wait a second, we're going to extend the tax reductions, the tax rates that we have, right? And we're not going to have any receipts. You know, that was on a budget that was based on something else back then. And they're like, don't worry. We got the tariffs coming in that will, shore up some of the billions of dollars. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden now we have the tariff issue that is under pressure, potentially with the last look at what the Supreme Court did last Wednesday, mm-hmm. or at least the questions they asked. They didn't do anything, but the questions they asked, I don't think that necessarily, but There's been a big concern about the U.S. quality of our bonds. Not this. I'm talking about our sovereign bonds. I'm not talking about junk or anything like that. But the sovereign bonds, because there's been a big concern about the political, I don't know, chaos that's going on here. Our debt to GDP. We used to laugh at your home country, Spain. Remember that?
Ah, yeah.
Look at that. Look at the debt to GDP of Italy. I think Spain was part of the pigs, wasn't it? Right?
Yeah, but I think there is a big difference with the USA.
What's the difference?
You work harder, you have cheaper energy, and you have less regulation. So I think the debt burden of the USA is not comparable to the debt burden of Spain or even now Germany. It's not the same when you owe $1 million to the bank, but you make every year $1 million. And furthermore, your prospects are bettering, are getting better. And you expect to make next year $1.5 million because you're really doing very well in your job. Then being indebted to the bank, $1 million, and your salary goes by, gets cut by half. Mm-hmm. And then you only make $1.5 million. So I think, I tell you very frankly, if you avoid civil war, I tell you as bluntly as this, if you Americans avoid civil war, I think you will end up well. I think eventually your debt will be repaid because you're going to create, you have cheap energy. Europe does not have cheap energy. You have cheap energy. You have much less regulations than Europe. And furthermore, the trend in the USA is toward less regulations, not more. Just the opposite as Europe. And furthermore, you work hard. So you are, look at France, for instance, we talk about debt, sustainability of debt. Look at France. In the very moment a prime minister says that they maybe should cut down some entitlements, look, the country's on fire, literally. The country's on fire.
Right.
So I think it's a very different situation.
Since we're giving out advice about countrymen, I would think that if Spain would take shorter siestas in the afternoon and eat earlier in the evening, not at like 10 o'clock at night, that maybe maybe there'll be more productivity there. What do you think?
We have to work harder. Look, in Europe, there are lots of vacations.
So many vacations, holidays they call them. They don't even call them vacations, they call them holidays.
Now, holidays in Europe, vacations in the USA. But anyway, it's not working. It means you sit idle. You sit idle, whatever you call it. France is even worse than Spain because we stereotype Spain as siesta. But to tell you the truth, I am more optimistic with Spain than with France, even though I'm very pessimistic with all Europe. France is really unbelievable. 6 weeks vacation, then furthermore, now they say they want to work Fridays off. So they are working already 35 hours a week. This is already from a long time ago. And now they are talking about Friday free. Not casual Friday. No. Friday free.
Friday free, yeah.
So you are not going to solve your economic issues by working less. So this is why I still think you have a decent possibility in the USA to pull it off, really.
So
increase productivity. I think you can make it.
Aside from those issues with regard to the liquidity, civil war, of course, that's not good. Or things of that. I'm talking about technical indicators. Mm-hmm. What do you have to see turn to get you to the next point? Okay, you know what? We are now potentially rolling and we have to make a change to our allocation.
Well, first off, my time indicators.
Yeah.
You know, I live and die by my time indicators. They really work very well. But okay, if I set aside the time indicators, then it's going to be earnings revisions, not declining earnings, because when you get the decline in earnings, the market is already down. So you have to look at the rate of change of earnings revisions, which is more important. So I always pay attention to the rate of change of earnings revisions. And secondly, once again, liquidity. So I pay attention to what's happening to the repo market, to high yield bonds, all these indicators of liquidity. And don't forget what's doing China, because it's a global market. If China is inflating, there is a spillover effect. So some of this liquidity will also end up in the USA.
Yeah, any kind of stimulus from anywhere somehow always finds its way into risk assets.
Permeates, yeah. Spills over. Mm-hmm. So I keep an eye on the USA, but I also keep an eye on China. So, for instance, now we are to a little extent contracting liquidity, but China is expanding. So we have also to keep an eye on China. And more locally, we have to look at what's going on with repos, with high yield bonds, to look whether a temporary liquidity crisis is temporary because it's just liquidity, or it's a deeper issue like solvency.
But you're not going to make any moves on that. Well, you're not going to make any moves on that. You're going to wait for your indicators to hit, right?
Watch out. And then you have the model of all bear markets. But if it's just a liquidity issue and the Fed does not screw up, then the liquidity issue is going to be work out. It's not going to be a big issue.
But you're not.
I keep an eye on both things: earnings revisions and liquidity.
But let me ask you. Can I ask you something? Can you hear me? All right, so I can hear you now. So just to go back and circle back. The issue with regard to you mentioned, well, earnings revisions, and you mentioned civil war, and you all these things. But yet, you're. I don't think. Tell me if I'm wrong. I don't think you're going to make any changes until your timing indicators tell you to do so, right?
Yeah, right.
So all these things are good talking points and concern factors, red flags maybe even, or even cautionary warning flags to get ready for something potentially, right? Because that's what history has shown you. But the fact is you stay disciplined.
Very disciplined.
And
you know why?
Yeah, well, tell me why. I know why.
Yeah, because my indicators are smarter than I am. So they discover what's going to happen. They are technical indicators. So if it's going down, don't argue. Don't argue with that.
It's kind of very simple.
If
like
it's going down, it's going down.
Isn't that when you like step back and look at a chart and don't know what's going on, and you say, okay, well, what's going to happen? Well, it's obviously going down. You know what I mean? It's like it's obviously went down, and you think about this, and you're like, well, why did I stay long, or why did I go short, or whatever, right? Why did I do what I did? Why was I in? Why was it out? And the thing is, it's like those indicators, like some of them, it's like, well, like I look at the moving average convergence divergence indicator, which seems to be one of those that newbie investors love to use on a technical analysis platform, or the RSI, for example. But the moving average convergence divergence indicator basically is just another representation of the same thing you're seeing on price action, right?
Exactly. It's a derivative. Exactly.
So
exactly.
It's like, oh, look, it's going down. It's like, yeah, but so is the stock. So, or it's going up. Well, so is it. It's going up. Look at that. It's crossing. Well, that's because it's moving up fast. You know, it's kind of funny. It's like, well, didn't you see that in the first chart to begin with? And something to consider. I'm just saying that these things, what you have is a sophisticated protocol based on a lot of different conditions that if they meet, and if not one, but not two, three, going the right direction is where you're fully invested, right?
Exactly. That's the point. Not all trend following is the same. So if you're going to time the market with moving average, you're going to fail. Maybe you will reduce a little bit drawdowns, maybe, but you will not outperform. This is very clear. No, you need, for instance, you know, I use the Dow theory with three indexes. So it means we need confirmation. Confirmation really works, not only within the realm of the Dow theory. Take even a moving average, and if you require confirmation from another index, you will see that you get rid of lots of noise and whipsaws. So, of course, we use confirmation, the concept of secondary reaction, which I think I explained in another interview. Mm-hmm. So the Dow theory is a much more sophisticated, does not mean complicated. Watch out.
Right.
But it's a more sophisticated method to appraise trends. So it's not as simple as say, hey, look, rate of change or MACD or whatever. No, it's a little bit more sophisticated, not complicated, but of course it entails confirmation. Not any pivot on the chart is a relevant pivot, because we use the concept of secondary reaction, which means that some pivots on the chart are technically irrelevant. So if you a breakout does not carry any significance. So of course, it's more sophisticated, but it's based on some principles. Principle of confirmation, that you need some time for a secondary reaction to unfold, that you need some extent. It's not the same a 2% drop in 10 days that a 7% drop in 10 days. So the latter has more significance. And of course, then when you have the right market timing tools, then you can time the market. And this is why I trust more. Furthermore, when you use three indexes, as I do, this is very similar to breadth, because to some extent, when we say, oh, I look for confirmation, okay, what's confirmation? Confirmation means that another index, which is made of several stocks, of many stocks, at the same time, is confirming means that there is good breadth internally. Because if the S&P makes a higher high, but the Dow Industrials does not, it means that the 30 stocks in the Dow Industrials are having poor breadth, because otherwise the Dow Industrials would be confirming. So to some extent, some of the tools I use is a surrogate of also breadth, which is very much in vogue nowadays. So, you know, and it's based on some principles. Blight time indicator, okay, it's based on trends as well, but it also incorporates margin debt, because there is a direct relationship between the trend of margin debt and the trend of the stock market.
Well, but that's the same thing we just talked about. More margin debt means more buying, which means the stocks go up. But here's the thing. Let's talk about that, because I think this is an important item. As of September 2025, the FINRA margin debt was a record high of $1.13 trillion, a record high. The problem with margin is not just simply taking money and putting it into the market, because it's money on top of money, right?
Yeah.
So we also doubled, almost doubled, the margin debt levels since December 2022. Are we any concerns about this? I mean, I know it's good that we have margin debt. It's expansive. What does it indicate? It indicates either one, investor confidence, or two, investor stupidity. Look at it either way you want, right? But the problem is the potential. I haven't seen it yet, but the potential for adding that to like the same day margin, same day options, or you know, single day options, 0 day options. And all the leverage, we're not even talking about the margin that's been put into leverage products. That's a leverage upon leverage.
Yeah.
Any concern about that?
Look, margin is a double-edged sword. So first, yeah, it's at very high levels, but if you adjust the total level of margin debt by market cap, you will see that it's not so horrible. Because the absolute value is very high. It's very true that it has rallied a lot in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. But if you adjust for market cap, well, it's high, but it's not as high. Secondly, since I am a trend follower, something that looks ridiculous, expensive or ridiculous or overblown, like now margin, can continue to go higher. So this is why I also measure the trend of margin debt, but not based on moving averages, because they don't work. I measure the trend based on Dow 30 patterns, which is different. Mm-hmm. In other words, now we can say that margin debt is very high. True. It's not at its highest if you divide per market cap. But who knows whether it's going to continue going higher? I have no idea. So we write trends. So it would be very tricky to call a top in the stock market because margin debt looks expensive. Furthermore, there is another study I performed that says that normally margin debt peaks some 5-6 months in advance of the stock market. So in other words, now we had in September, latest data, very, very high figures of margin debt.
Just to be clear, record high.
Yeah, record high. Unadjusted, yes, record high. So let's imagine that now drops in October and in November.
Okay.
So if we see a peak on the chart of margin debt, it normally tends to peak 5-6 months before the stock market. So then it would be a yellow light, not a red light, but a yellow light. Look, the stock margin debt has peaked. But we are trend followers. It's high, maybe not in October. It will decline a little bit. I expect it to decline because of the liquidity hiccup. But maybe in November, it makes a higher high. So we are trend followers. So until I get really solid evidence that the trend of margin debt has changed, I consider it bullish for the stock market. And when will you consider that the trend of margin debt is bearish? Okay, I use Dow 30 patterns, so not a moving average. So I have to hit higher high, lower lows, it's a bit too long to explain here. But once I'm convinced that the trend has changed, not just a minor pullback, then this is bearish for the stock market, but we are not in this situation yet.
All right. I'll buy that. I'll buy that. I mean, but it does seem to me that things are getting a little bit frothy. And like you said, I think we both agree that it's okay for market. In fact, it sometimes gives you opportunities to, if markets do pull back. And that is a normal part of the process. I just don't want to make it too normalized that people are like, oh, no big deal. You know, we start talking about things like what they talk about with crypto. Like, it's the crypto winter. That's fine. You know, we have those every once in a while, these 20-30% drawdowns. Like, really? Seriously? Is that what we're going to talk about now? crazy stuff. Manuel Bly, tell us how to get the information. We're going to, of course, have all the information on the show notes for episode 946 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, where you can find the stuff. But you tell me where people can go to get your newsletter.
Well, you can go to thedowntheory.com. This is our website.
Thedowntheory.com.
Thedowntheory.com. Mm-hmm. Everything together. Thedowntheory.com.
Okay.
And furthermore, there's also lots of free stuff. So
we like free stuff.
Yeah, we love free stuff. Furthermore, there is one very good one on why valuations look high, but they are not as high, which is a little bit academical, but it links capital per capita, so per head, and also liquidity, and both have an influence of market valuations.
Good stuff.
The richer a country becomes, and this is an insight I owe to Ludwig von Mises, the Austrians, so the higher, there is a natural rate of interest, and the higher the capital per head, per capita, the lower the natural rate of interest. This makes sense. So if capital is plentiful, you will lend it at a lower interest rate than when capital is not plentiful. It makes sense.
Yeah.
So the marginal utility of capital. So in other words, the richer a country becomes, the lower the discount rate, the theoretical interest rate will be. This is not the Fed one, but the and this means the higher the price to earnings ratio will tend to go. And this is why many value measures don't seem to work anymore. There is a second variable. Liquidity also affects valuations. There's a direct relationship. So when you put the two of them together, then you may reach the conclusion that, okay, it's a little bit frothy, but what looks expensive today, maybe it's not so expensive. I don't say it's cheap. Eh? The market is not a bargain now.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be very careful with valuations. And furthermore, since our timing, I'm a market timer, my timing horizon is 1 year. So the average duration of my trades is 1 year. So even high valuations, wherever is high, because it's not so clear, don't have any value in forecasting the next year. It has some value in forecasting the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
But for market timers, it's really not so important.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that the market is...
No, I get it. It's a different way of doing things. That's the bottom line. Market timing, using the disciplines versus a valuation metric, it's black and white. It's different. It's all totally... I totally get it. We're going to wrap it up there. Hopefully, the next time we get together, we'll be looking back at your young bull market call from... November, the beginning of November 2025. We'll see how that plays out. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me on your show. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, buddy. See ya. And another great show in the bag. We have some great guests coming up. Look, next week, Ross Gerber. We have Tim Knight coming up, who somehow we always time it where there's all of a sudden a big rollover in the markets. Then we have Howard Silverblatt coming up the following week into the end of November. He is the keeper of the information for S&P Dow Jones Global Indices. And I'm looking forward to having him. It's been a while since he's been on, but he knows all the details about every single thing, things that we talked about today, about PE ratios, but also digging down deep into the actual numbers. So that's a pretty exciting interview and some discussion that we're going to have. Make sure that you go over to either Amazon Music or Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from, and you subscribe and you make sure to leave a review. That is really appreciated. Any information you want to know about what we do, go over to the episode notes or the show page or the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again really soon. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.